Monday the 3rd of December, Tov Gimel Kislev, Rabbi Jonathan Giffentag, the Halachic Aftermath of 9/11.
Good morning, thank you for providing an audience for me to share my thoughts with on the subject of the Halachic Aftermath of 9/11. The main Halachic Aftermath of 9/11, that great both a challenge, a tragedy obviously for so many thousands of people who lost their lives, and at the same time a challenge to the Western world, a wake-up call, as the political leaders saw it, that there's big problems that not only the Jewish people face against the enemies surrounding them, but indeed a whole challenge to the whole Western world. Leaving aside the global aspect of 9/11, we're going to talk about the halachic aftermath of 9/11, in particular the shalos of Aguno that arose as a result of so many men and Jewish men sadly not coming home the evening of 9/11, back to the wives and families, leaving the wives in the Aguno. And the question is, what are the principles, what are the practicalities involved in allowing a woman to remarry if her husband is no longer around the place? So the first thing is, this is it's not a new question. It's obviously as old as the halachic hills, as it were. And in particular, for those who recently been to the Daf Yomi, as they got to the end of Yomos, then the Dafim Kufchot, the Kufchot place, or so, are the main places where these discussions and the principles are first elucidated, and on which obviously we're everything else is built. Similarly, Eben O Ezen, Shulchan Aruch, Simon Yud Zayin, there's the 50-60 Simonim, which form the basis for everything else emergence. Just a note that Aguna nowadays, the sort of a modern day meaning, and there's a classical meaning. Classical meaning of Aguna is what we're dealing with. There was a woman who was chained, literally Ogun and Anchor, chained, she's chained to her foot, to her husband, even though he's not around, he's really disappeared. So what are the halakhic means of establishing probability of death? The modern term of Aguna is for certain cases where people, having got married, two willing people decided to get married, then as you know in halacha, in order to effect a divorce in Jewish law, two willing people have got to decide to divorce, and as we know it sometimes never arises that people decide that they're not going to play the game in the appropriate gentlemanly manner, and they decide to withhold the get for a time or for a long time, and that's more really a situation of arbitration and good counselling that's necessary in order to effect a complete break and get a get. But the term Aguna has come to involve that scenario. But this morning we're going to deal with the classical situation of an Aguna. So the first thing in to be matter in Aguna is that the based in. And in particular, it won't just be a Beis Din, it'll normally be three of sort of Gedolim, Gedolei Hador, rabbinic authorities with extensive experience of dealing with these matters will be called upon to issue the ruling at the end of the day. And generally, that's the minig, that three great rabbonim from different communities or from around the place will be called upon to make this ruling. And indeed, after 9/11, the Meshive Hador have been asked to provide these sort of rulings. So the first thing to do in making such a ruling would be to first of all to establish what the facts are. There's no use conjecturing. In order to permit this woman to remarry, we have to establish exactly what the sequence of events was that occurred on that day, and to put it down on paper, you can see in the handout there, you can see there was a sort of definitely established that there was a North Tower at 8:46 New York time. The airplane went in to floors 93 to 98. There were no known survivors above the 92nd floor. It collapsed at 10:29 a.m. an hour and three quarters later. And the South Tower, the plane went in at 9:02, that was in floors 84 to 87, it collapsed at 9:59, and above the floor 78 there were 10 survivors. In other words, getting precise data as to what happened and when. Okay, the subject of trying to be Matir and Aguna divides itself into three categories of three scenarios that can actually arise. The first one is where you actually have a body, a goof or some form of remains to deal with, to say that here's a body. Is it the particular man that we're talking about? And how do you establish and identify remains? Where what are the halachic criteria for so doing? Category B is where there's no body or no remains to question to debate. Is this the missing husband or not? Simply there's an absence of a body. Person's disappeared. There's nobody there. And the person's disappeared, and then we get into the issue of Mayim She'ein Lahem Soif. And thirdly, the third category is where not only have you got no body, and you also have no evidence that they definitely were it, that anybody knows that they even went near the place. Maybe they didn't go to work that morning, and they never got there. Maybe they took a long train out to the other side of America. And then took transportation to South America and they disappeared. Okay, so those are the three categories, and let's start at the top, therefore, with the first situation, that is identifying remains. We've got remains in front of us. How do we actually go about saying that these belong to the husband, the missing husband? So the first one is the Mishnah, the Gemara talk about a classical simonim of establishing where we've got a mace, lefonenu, and so the first thing is the Mishnah says if it's within 3 days of the death, then it's going to be more halachically easy to identify, and secondly if you've got the head and the face and the forehead and the nose, it's going to be much more easy to make an identification. Then the halacha goes on to say, well, what happens if you haven't necessarily got that? Then the halacha goes to talk about various levels of simonim that would be necessary in sort of descending order of strength that can help you make an identification. The first one is the simon muvuk, where you've got an outstanding feature. The second is the simon beinoni. This is an average sort of feature of the person, and the third category is simon garua, where it's a very sort of low level of identification. The best, obviously, is that if you've got a simon muvak, and so the question is, what is considered the simon muvak? So the Balei Halacha say that this means that if less than 1 in 1,000 people share that feature, then that's already a simon muvak. It's an outstanding feature which helps you to make an identification. And there's another halachic principle that says that 2 simonim beinoniim, sort of medium features, 2, you sort of lump 2 together, and then that can produce you a sort of algebraic type of simon muvuk. Okay, so why are we so concerned with this? So the answer is because the way that we go about that nowadays the people go about making identifications, they'd use 2 sort of modern day techniques. The first one is dental records, and the second is DNA. So already with dental records, this is not something new, because obviously people have had teeth for a long time, and so the question is that the Beis Shmuel says that nekev mefulush b'shein is a simon muvuk, a hole right through the tooth is considered the simon muvuk. Long comes the Aruch HaShulchan and later Achronim and say, yeah, but nowadays there's such tooth decay, everybody's got holes in their teeth, and so that therefore it no longer can surely be a way of identifying somebody. But nevertheless, now however, you see just a simple hole in the tooth, that's sort of a low level of dental records. As we know, dental records nowadays means that the dentist can sort of give you take the whole file out and then show in all of the 30 odd teeth what he's done in each bit and what metal he's put where and etc. So then already we've got a Igros Moshe Eben Ezra in the 1950s where a man died in an aeroplane crash off the East River in New York, And one of the ways that they used in order to be matir his wife was Mr. Alfred so-and-so. He fell in the East River in 1959 in New York, and so one of the things that Moshe did was that he phoned up the dentist on Fifth Avenue in New York, and he got his records out, and he had a look at his teeth, and so one of the factors that was used was indeed dental records. Now, most up-to-date, obviously, is the question of DNA. And so DNA, which is the unique coded imprint of genetic fingerprint of what a person's body and particles are made up of, that has been discovered. The question is, what do the modern day Balei Halacha say about it? So there seems to be two schools of thought. Rav Vosner in Bnei Brak says it's only regarded as a simon beinoni. However, Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, son-in-law, says that in fact it's a simon. He argues it's a simon muvak, and for the reasons that we established before, that the definition of a simon muvak is what if it's shared by less than 1,000 people. And so, as we know, DNA goes into even sort of slimmer chances of duplication than that. Okay, so the whole subject in itself, I'm just giving you a sort of an overguide and a tour through the whole thing. And so we note those two positions. But clearly, as we'll see, no one factor in being matter and aguna, you won't just be matter and aguna on the basis of one factor. There'll be a laundry list of different factors and different sniffing that can be aggregated all together in order to produce the whole picture and eventually produce the bottom line. There is a halachic issue of trusting the civil authorities in halachic matters. Do we or don't we? There's a lot of argumentation back and forward on that subject. And the bottom line seems to be an Aruch HaShulchan in Siman Yud Zayin, who says that with other corroboration, then we would accept the statements of of the halachic authorities. It's presumed that they're not going to. The civil authorities are presumed that they won't. It's presumed that they won't make statements in order to boast, and in order that they'll be sober-headed and level-headed and reliable and accurate, etc. Okay, so there's a whole debate about that. The next issue that arises, still while we're talking about whether somebody or something to go on, right? We haven't yet got to the second category where there's been complete disappearance. So there's still the first category where if not somebody, then there's something to go, some physical thing, and that is if you find an item of clothing or an item of personal effect that you know belonged to that person, his wallet, his credit cards, his trousers, his briefcase, found in the wreckage, do we say that that is sufficient evidence? So already for that, you've got a Shulchan Aruch in Siman Yud Zayin, which says that there is a problem of chayshinon l'she'ela, that you're worried and concerned that perhaps he will have lent them, he will have lent these items to, here we go, Se'if Kaplar Matsu Horego Meis in Padata V'chodim Padav Ponokayim Me'idim Rav Bim Nidl If the primary features of the face and the, as we said before, the forehead and the nose are gone, then even though his kalim, his personal effects might be around, and there might be simonim muhokim in the kalim, einom klum dechayshinon l'sheela, because the concern is that he will have lent these things to other people. So then the question is, can we nevertheless get around that by saying, yeah, but there's certain things that he won't have lent to other people? So for instance, do people lend each other their trousers? I don't know. You know, open question. So you can think about it and debate it. You'd say, well, even if a certain category of people would be a mole and lend each other their trousers, the question is, when you've got a man in a pinstripe suit going in a bowler hat, and now they don't do it, going to the World Trade Center on a Tuesday morning, would he be going there to his business meetings in borrowed trousers? So less likelihood of that being the case, and so possibly that could be used as a as a further sniff. What do you say?
Less than 1,000.
What people
Nobody
who? Ah, that's the. Okay, there was actually a situation where they did find a trousers and wallet in Nile. Okay, we go on to the second category of where no remains are to be found, and there was evidence that the person was there, but they didn't come home. And then we get to the case of Mayim She'ein Lehem Soif. What's the case of Mayim She'ein Lehem Soif? The Mishnah in the Gemara says, Mayim She'yesh Lehem Soif Ishtoi Muteres, Mayim She'ein Lehem Soif Ishtoi Asur. What does that mean? Mayim She'ein Lehem Soif means that the body of water has no horizontal end in sight. In other words, if you've got a small, horizontally sort of a short distance from one end to the other, then a person can stand by the side of the lake or the pond and see if the person went down and didn't come up, then Mayim She'yesh Lehem Soif, you can see that there's a boundary, and the person, if they didn't come up, it's a sign they're still down there, and there's a limit to how long they can be holding their breath. And therefore, if after a certain amount of hours or days, whatever it is, it didn't come up, then ishto matos. If, however, it's mayim she'ein lehem soif, then the fact that they didn't appear after a certain amount of hours is not necessarily a proof that they died, because they might have done a bit of a swim, and they might have emerged a few hundred yards down the river, and they might be living happily, maybe a bit wet, let us dried out by now, and so therefore the woman is still halachically married. Okay, so what to do, so the first thing is that it's not just water that's considered mayim she'ein lehem soif, but even other situations of can also be considered mayim she'ein lehem soif, nafal l'toch kivshon ha'esh. As the Shulchan Aruch says, in Sif Lamed, if he fell into a furnace of fire, or the first Yoreh Sachas Malei Yain Hashem and Maim, or a boiling hot cauldron, or Shoshot Bei Shnei Simon and Arubon, Meidin of Shemais, then Shevadai Soif Olamus, V'chein Kol Kiyot Zeboi Mitzvorim She'iach Shash Yichya El Yomus Miad Bezman Korot Hare Eilu Meidin of. So in other words, it's not just water, it's any it can sort of parallel drawn, not just water. Okay, so the first thing to do in trying to be matir an aguna in such a situation is first of all is to establish that there was domestic tranquility, there's peace and harmony at home. In other words, we're trying to show there's a problem, that there's no other reason, there's no particular reason why he didn't come home at night. It's not that there's a known pattern of brogus between them, or lack of shalom bayis. And so the Nodi Behuda says that in order to be matir and aguna, the first thing you've got to do is to establish that scenario at home. Mitchila amina shekol divrei hayteim shadabe beisha zu hu betanai shezehu ish reb shimon hanizga hayodar emishtai gederach kala oretz. He normally went on a business trip, and he normally came home, and he hasn't come home. It's obviously not that there's domestic problems, and he doesn't like it. He wants to be home, and he's not home. He's obviously dead. So the next point is that the building collapse. Is not a didn't happen for the first time at the World Trade Center. There's many cases recorded. We've got a bit of a problem that there's a Mishnah in the Gemara that talks about mace ukvartiv nemenes, that she's only believed if she states he died and I buried him. But there's truths about it that would show that we wouldn't require the ukvartiv. Okay. I now get to the most interesting part of Mayim She'ein Lehem Soif, and that is that there's a number of well-known, recognized heterim in the Tshuva literature that from the times of both the Rishonim and the Achronim that would help the Poskim come to a kulat decision on the question of an aguna. The first one is it's a Tosfos in Yevamos, which says that the reason why we need to be worried about Mayim She'en Lehem Sof Ishto Asura is because there's such a thing as a Miut Hamotzui. There's a sort of a ready identifiable and available minority of situations where he is not dead and he's alive. And therefore, Chayshin says Tosin Yevamos Lamed Vav and Beis. Chayshinim le Miut Hamotzui. You need to worry about this Miut Hamotzui. It might not be a right. It might only be a miut, but you need to be worried about that miut hamotzui that he survived in a significant minority of cases. So the first thing to do is then to say, okay, yeah. However, in our situation, 9/11, above floors, whatever it was, the 80s or 90s or whatever in building A or B, whatever it was, there's never mind the miut hamotzui. There was no miut. There's no miut shanim. There was nothing. Nobody survived. That's the first sort of method of approach to try and deconstruct the factors here to enable you to build a case for Heter. Point B is a Chiddush by Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Igros Moshe, after the war in Tshuva from the post-Holocaust, he was asked, what about the women who were left without a husband? The husband went into the camps. And we didn't see that they went into a gas chamber and the gas worked and he didn't come out and there was a corpse and they got buried. So how do we go about it in that situation? So Rav Moshe comes along with a chiddush that only Rav Moshe can come along with, and he shows that he suggests the following. Rav Moshe says that we will only apply the isur of ma'im she'en lam soif ishto asur. We will only apply the chumra there in a situation where normally that situation arises in regard to one person by themselves. Now, one person by themselves fell into a cauldron or into a river. Ma'im she'en lam soif ishto asur. However, in a situation which applies to a group of people, says Rav Moshe, Alzeh the takona was not made, and we are allowed to be mechalek in that way between in the terms of the original takona, and to yield heter and kula, and to say that we can presume that these people fit into the category of the rive who would die in such a situation, and therefore that will permit us to say that she can remarry. So it's Rav Moshe's chiddush that the chumra of ma'im she'en lehem sof only applies to individuals, doesn't apply to a group, and therefore Rav Moshe was matir these agunas from post Auschwitz. So that's obviously an important yisoid on which to build for our scenario of 9/11. It applied to a group, not to an individual. The next halachic major principle involves that of trei rube. Trei rube means two factors of rive, which each of them by themselves factors constitute a rive. That rive people in that situation would die, and that. So where does that originate from? It originates, so it's mainly stated in the Tshuva that from a couple of hundred years ago in Vilna, where there was a man on a bridge over a large river, and he fell from a great height into the river, and the river, well, it wasn't a nice summer's day, and he didn't go for a swim, it was ice, it was the winter, and then he fell onto the ice, and then from the ice he fell into a crack in the ice, and then he disappeared. If he'd obviously just fallen onto the ice, then the body would still be there. He fell from the ice into the water, and then Mayin She'ein Lehem Soif. Reb Chaim Volozhin was matir there, the woman to get the widow to get remarried, and first of all, established that she was a widow, and therefore he allowed her to get remarried on the basis of trei rube, two rives. Here, what's the two rives? Rive, people that fall off a bridge, not only get a headache, unfortunately, but they die. And rive, people who fall from the ice into the water, don't just go for a swim, they also die. So you've got two rives in order to be matched. There is a... how much time do we have? How many minutes? 5 minutes. Oh, you're off. Maybe I'll come back to that one. Something else to tell you about trei rube. So that trei rube is a very important sort of lumdish and sort of halachic. It seems to be the main thing to do to try and establish in each situation that you've got two roives. So again, in 9/11, it was a matter of trying to construct the Trey Rube scenario in regard to the falling the twin towers, and that most, as Rabbi Yosef says, that most people at or above the point of the plane's impact perished, and most, or if not all, of those who survived were discovered by the rescuers. So Rabbi Yosef tried to construct a Trey Rube scenario there. Okay, the next principle that's used, number four, is it concerns the issue of advances in communication. Meaning like this. The Gemara talks about a Talmud Chacham, be'it Tzuvim Reb Bonon Hu, then Ishto Muteres. Why? Because if he was Taka still alive, then he's such a celebrity and outstanding person, it would be known about. If the news would get back, and therefore the fact that nobody knows about him, the fact that there's nothing to be heard, is a proof that he's dead. And so there's then the machlokes back and forth, or the sort of different opinions offered. The Trumas Hadeshen, one of the Rishonim, he says that in his generation that applies to everybody, because the great methods and modes of communication are great nowadays, he says, and so therefore everybody who can say that if nothing's been heard, they're therefore definitely alive. The Chasam Sofer talks about the same sort of thing. I'm sorry, definitely dead. Chasam Sofer talks about the same sort of idea. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Adi Yosef. It's used as a sniff nowadays to be made up. The next principle that's used is by Rabbi Loza of Verona or Verdun, not quite sure which one it is, either somewhere in Italy or Spain, and that's cited by the Zichron Yehuda, the son of the Rosh, who makes again a chiddush, and he says when the Gemara says Ishta Asura, it doesn't say Ishta Asura lo Olam, it says Ishta Asura for the time being. Once the time being has gone by, and then there's a debate, does it mean 1 year, does it mean 4 years, does it mean 7 years, then already you can start and say that if he hasn't come back, then he's definitely dead, and Ishto will be Muteris. Lastly, yeah, the most sort of, perhaps the most inventive bit of Polish chilukim going on here, that of the Shvus Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reisha, who said that, look, the Gemara says that b'di'eved leiteitzeh, niseis leiteitzeh, b'di'eved leiteitzeh. She says that in Halacha we find the principle that says that shas adachak k'di'eved domi, that an emergency situation is like a situation of b'di'eved. So it's caused a lot of excitement, obviously, and interest as to why we should say that, because surely all agunas are shachar b'chak. And okay, but it is used and it's recorded. Rabbi Yaakov Reisha, the great Shmuel Yaakov, he says that is one of the mechanisms that can be used. So we see that in the case of Manshan and Sof, there are six different issues that can be raised, and together they can produce a package. The question is, though, obviously, the question of questions. What's going on here? How can we matter anything here? Surely, so you're talking about Arroyos. If he's still alive, how can you get, even if you've got a slightest doubt in your mind that he's still alive, how can you be matter her to remarry? So the answer is that what emerges from the Gemara and the Mepharshim over there is that what we're dealing here with the inbuilt halachic check and balance built into the system, meaning like this, that when a ruling is issued that she can remarry, it's still nevertheless the assumed onus is on her of Isha Daika Uminsula. That a woman would not dream of getting remarried unless she knew 100 billion% that her husband is Taka no longer alive. Why? Why? Because as the Mishnah listed out, there's about 13 or 14 ramifications to her remarrying if her husband's still alive, right? Teitze mizu mizu. Eina kesuba mizu mizu. Mamzerim, obviously the big nuclear button is the Mamzerim issue. So a huge amount of ramifications that mean that therefore the halakha relied on him, relied on her, not dreaming of getting remarried, because she'd be putting herself in the most unbelievable stuff if she were to make a false move and marry if he really was definitely not definitely dead. And so therefore that is what allows us, so therefore the poskim say therefore that that when it says Mayim Shen Lam Sof Ishtar Surah, it means it's a takona drabonon, and therefore when you're dealing with a drabonon, you're that then heterim and kulas and snifim the hokel come into the picture, and provided you can build a real convincing case involving various snifim, then you'll be able to issue a ruling. One final anecdote, and that is recently I had in my community the Rav of Lyon in France, Rav Yichya Tabulas, Bal Machaba Tshuva Sfarim, and he's got a particular noted situation, very sad, sad event that arose in his city there in Lyon in about 1995-96. There's a young couple, never 3 months old, 3 months, they're 3 months married, and they're walking by the river, I think it's the River Rhone there in the city centre, the big fast road, and then the river, and an embankment up to the river, and they're walking on a path there, late at night one night. And they hear the sound of a woman threatening to commit suicide. So the husband says he's going to go and try and rescue her. So he takes a run up the embankment, and as he gets to the top, she jumps over the side, and he follows. And he didn't realise that, because it's completely pitch black, he didn't realise that at the top of the embankment there's a sheer drop, and there's a concrete ledge. And that was the last, and she was heard crying and screaming in the water, but nothing was heard of him ever again. A few days later, her body turned up in the few hundred yards down the river or so, and never his body didn't turn up. And then this woman remained in Aguna for several years, and it was a question of how to be matir about Aguna, the tshuva in the Vadi Yosef. In the Yabia Omer, and Rabbi Tabul takes issue in his work with the basis of Rabbi Yosef, but basically it hinged on the issue of Trey Rube, about how to construct the two rives, a mechanism that is so essential. So what was the Trey Rube? The most people go into the river, and even if it went into the concrete ledge, most people that fall from such a height onto a concrete ledge would also die. Ravadi Yosef had his Trey Rube, Rabbi Tabul tried to show a different form of Trey Rube, but we see that these tshuvas are there, the mechanisms are there. Nebuch, we should be spared of such situations and only know of good things from Kol Yisrael, but at the end of the day, we've got the Emunah that our Gedolim can help us out of situations in all cases. Thank you.
Thank you, John.